Hello, podcast listener. You're listening to a Halford and Brough podcast, and I'm using my podcast voice. You can listen to us on Google, Apple, Spotify. It's the Halford and Brough podcast, and thank you for listening.
7:02 on a Wednesday. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. The Halford and Brough Show in the morning is brought to you by the Dilari family of Acura dealers. Dilari Acura, colon, we got Acuras. I really think it's coming into shape. It's coming into
form. I think you should stop saying colon.
Right.
Just Dilari Acura. They got Acuras.
I'm talking about the punctuation mark, of course.
Yeah, you don't have to do that, period.
Punctuation mark. That could also be two different things.
Hey, Mike, comma, who's our next guest? Question mark.
Greg Wyshynski, M dash, joins us now. ESPN.com. It's Wish Wednesdays here on the Halford and Brough Show. What up, Wish?
Hello. How is everybody doing?
Things are good.
Doing great.
Not good, Greg. Mike is lying.
All the jerseys that have come out in the last 24 hours, everybody's in love with them. They all look great.
We got bigger problems up here, Wish. We got a hockey team that can't win games. And we got a hockey team that doesn't seem to be making any changes. Are you surprised that there haven't been changes to the Canucks?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, and it makes me wonder whether, and I think we've talked about this before, whether Jim Benning gets to fire anybody is kind of the question right now. Because normally at this point in the trajectory of this season, and with the tenure of the coach, there'd be a coaching change at the very least. So you start to wonder exactly what's going on behind the scenes, and so far as, you know, how many people ownership want to pay to not coach, right? At this juncture, no, it's a mess, and you know, I'm a little bit surprised there isn't a bit more action being taken, whether it's transactional or through personnel changes. It strikes me as curious. I don't know about you guys.
There's some reporting going around that the league might have recommended a candidate like Jim Rutherford for the Canucks. Does the league often recommend candidates for teams?
The league recommends candidates for teams for every opening for a general manager spot. It's kind of a well-known secret. I don't know what other phraseology you'd want to use there. Open secret. There's the word I was
looking
for.
There you go. There you go.
Where the league recommends candidates to owners insofar as who they think is in the pipeline and who they think could help a certain situation. There have been times when this has been reported. Like, for example, it's famous that the league recommended Steve Yzerman to Jeff Vinnick when he bought the Tampa Bay Lightning, for example.
Okay.
And they are helpful when it comes to new owners in these situations, but they're also helpful to established owners in giving them lists of people that they think could help certain situations. If you ask around the league, there can sometimes be a fight to get on those lists and to curry favor with the right people to ensure that you are on those lists. It's not out of the ordinary at all for the league to recommend people to owners for potential GM jobs, being that they're big business. And not only GM, I mean, like president of hockey operations, stuff like that as well.
We're speaking to Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. This is an intriguing conversation. I don't want to pivot off it, but I feel like we are burying the lead of the most singular, important journalistic piece, quite frankly, of the last two decades that I've read, and that was Greg Wyshynski going to UBS Arena and not just going to all 17 bars in the arena, but writing about it in great detail. I want to know more about this. I want our listeners to truly understand the task you undertook. Also, is there a speakeasy in there as well?
So to answer your first question, when I took a tour of UBS Arena, they kept talking up the amount of bars they were going to have because they obviously know their audience, not only me, but Islanders fans. The other thing about that place, too, is that tailgating had always been a real part of the culture for Islanders fans, and it's not allowed at UBS Arena, according to their charter, right? So I'm sure fans will find a way to do it, but technically not allowed. So I was very curious about where Islanders fans would imbibe from this point on. So 17 bars, and that's not counting the places where you can just walk up and get a tall boy. And they tried to create a little bit of personality in each one. There's a giant outdoor terrace that reminds you of those places that you want to maybe party at when you're at the shore, but then you never go there because you're afraid of like somebody roofying you. And then, there's a resurrected pub called the Offside Tavern that used to be an Islanders bar in Manhattan that closed during COVID. But one of the bars is a speakeasy. It's located in the 100 level. It's two nondescript wooden doors. And eventually, when people become more aware of it, which I know is antithetical to being a speakeasy, but nonetheless, they are going to have a password that you'll need to know in order to get into the bar. I suggested Milbury as the password. I think that'd be an amazing password for Islanders fans. But yeah, it's a speakeasy. And the weird thing about it is that there's no radio feed. There's no TV. Once you're inside, it's almost like you're in a completely separate world than the rest of the arena. But I came up with the idea. I thought it'd be an interesting way to write about opening night, and it seemed like it's resonated. So I appreciate everybody that checked it out.
Do fans like the rink? I have to admit, I was a little bit worried that the atmosphere would suffer because of the new rink and the Islanders games during the playoffs from the Coliseum. Even watching those games on TV was must watch for me for the atmosphere inside the rink.
Well, it's hard to say right now because I suck, right? So it's hard to really get a good decibel level at UBS Arena compared to Nassau Coliseum because the team's not very good right now. I think from what I gathered from fans, they really appreciate the fact that it seems like an arena that was made for them. Not only, the number of bars, but, you can find pictures on Twitter of this. There's a giant mural above one of the bars that depicts the logos of all of the Islanders fan meetup organizations from around the world, from like Brazil to the UK. And it's little touches like that that I think really resonate with them. And I think the biggest thing for an Islanders fan, to be honest with you, is not necessarily what the building looks like. And trust me when I tell you that, after going through the Barclays Center experience in Brooklyn, where the rink was, it wasn't built for hockey and the Islanders fans all hated it, no matter what they came up with, it was going to clear that bar. The biggest thing for Islanders fans is permanence. This has been an organization that has been worried about relocation maybe every day for the last 20 years. In some cases, it got closer than others. They've seen stops and starts on arena projects for decades. And to finally have their own place and to have ownership in place that clearly loves the franchise and clearly is going to support the franchise, I think they're just mostly happy about that. Mostly happy about having a sense of permanence and knowing that this team isn't in danger of leaving for the next few decades.
Hey, Wish, I want to bring the conversation back to the Canucks and specifically Jim Rutherford. His name is being thrown out there as one that was potentially recommended to the Canucks by the league. He left the Penguins in a rather secretive way and reached out to a few people who still can't figure out why exactly he left the Penguins. First of all, do you know? And second of all, is it common knowledge that he's not ready to retire yet? He is 72 years old.
So let's start with his job aspirations. I've spoken to people that know Jim, and I think in a perfect world, he'd like to be president of hockey operations and not have to do the day-to-day job of being a general manager. There was some talk about him maybe coming into the Chicago situation and rescuing that team in the sense of the same way that the Penguins bought him on initially. If you remember, when he came out initially, it was to just be a Band-Aid. It was just to fix a bad situation in Pittsburgh for a team that felt like it very much had championship aspirations. And it worked. I mean, they won two cups, and then the temporary GM thing that Rutherford was going to do extended beyond that. And guys like Bill Guerin and Jason Botterill were left there waiting to see when they were going to be handed the keys. And neither of them got the keys to the Penguins, obviously. So there is sort of precedent of him coming into a situation looking to maybe just be a temporary GM and then serving in that capacity for a little bit longer. Now, as far as the Pittsburgh deal, the only two things I've heard from people, and by no means should this be considered to be gospel, is, there were some transactions that maybe he wanted to make that didn't necessarily jibe with what the team wanted to do. And then the other thing was, you listen, man, it's been a rough time for all of us as far as like COVID and the pandemic and having to live life the way we lived for a year. And for Rutherford, I heard, you know, it wasn't something he necessarily enjoyed, you know, the restrictions and all that stuff. So maybe as things have changed and the vaccine rollouts happen and everything else, it gets a little bit easier. But again, those were the only two sort of ancillary things that I've heard about his tenure in Pittsburgh ending.
You know, just to continue this conversation, I'm sorry I got so excited about wanting to talk about bars, but that's my very on brand for me. is, you know, the name Mike Ford and Sportsology has been making a lot of rounds. I understand that they kind of helped the Devils with their executive search. And eventually landing on Tom Fitzgerald, who was there the whole time, which I think kind of underscores it doesn't necessarily mean you have to bring in somebody new. It's just a review of what you've got and what you need moving forward. But those, it really seems like that's the next great frontier for finding really good executives, because you kind of mentioned something when they were talking about the NHL's candidate list and who they push forward. There's probably a lot of guys clamoring to be on that list that aren't, because they know right now that the majority, you said it every single time an opening comes up, the NHL has its list of preferred candidates. It is interesting to see that there might be an outside look at getting another guy in the door, as opposed to just saying, you know, who do Gary Bettman and Bill Daly and everyone else at the NHL's head office think might be the best guy for this job?
But NHL owners aren't like guys just like collecting hockey cards in their basement. Like, they all run businesses.
Sure. They need to look at somebody else to get a candidate. That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, like, I know that there's some people that are specialized in trying to find the right fit for sports organizations. And there are obviously agents out there as well that have a list of people that they think could be a good fit if you ring them up and ask them for their opinion. But I mean, these are giant corporate overlords that certainly have their own consultants and have their own processes for finding executives to hire for their own companies. And I'm sure it's the same thing for sports organizations. And I mean, the other thing too, is that, and the Tom Fitzgerald thing's a good example. I mean, it may be someone coming forward and saying, you should definitely hire this guy, but it's also a situation of just like the known commodity is always going to win out, whether it's the inherent nepotism of the NHL in, you know, relationships being the coin of the realm, or it's just simply sometimes wanting to have somebody who already has a familiarization with the organization. And I always come back to this example where when George McPhee got fired by the Washington Capitals and they hired Brian McClellan, a lot of us were like, that's a bad move. like he's going to be an extension of what was already there. And in actuality, what he was someone who had a familiarity with the roster, with the prospects, with the system, with the organization, and had a chance to come in and kind of, you know, edit it in the way that he felt he saw fit. And he wasn't a continuation of what George did. He was his own guy, and we all misjudged it, and they ended up winning a cup. So I do think that there's something to be said for not necessarily bringing in somebody who's a complete outsider into a situation. But in some cases, maybe that's the best thing to do, because I still think that in many cases, if you hire with from within, it's hard to kill your darlings. And you're always going to have certain people that are in the organization or on the roster that there's an inherent loyalty to that you may not want.
It's funny you mention that, because we had the exact same conversation, but about the coaching position. Where, I mean, I know you're probably not all that up to speed with the Vancouver Whitecaps, but they fired their manager mid-season and then essentially brought in a guy that had worked with them in lockstep for years. But the team went out and performed radically different. By that, I mean they won games and they played fundamentally differently. Everything changed, and you would have thought that there would have been that sort of McPhee-McClellan dynamic where it's just going to be more of the same. But it really wasn't. And we talk about with the coaching position in Vancouver, there's really one or two ways that they can go now if they're going to make that change. It's either go outside the organization and get someone who can, you know, play the fresh start card with everyone, or you bump up one of the assistants. And with that, the latter, we have noted that it's worked in places, most recently St. Louis, where Berube took the big chair and all of a sudden turned them into a Stanley Cup champion. So it is an interesting dynamic, because at times you think new coach means fresh start, but also you don't want someone completely from the outside, because there is a history here of guys getting promoted internally and it paying off.
Right, but Berube, and this is the dynamic that I think is important you have to remember with coaches versus general managers. In the case of general managers, it's a different skill set, and you might want somebody who does have established relationships with, say, like the leadership core on the team, And has a familiarity with the farm system, you know, having some level of familiarity and experience within the organization could be beneficial for a GM. The coaching situation is different because I think when you hire a coach, either you think what you're doing works or what you're doing doesn't work. And so in the case of the Florida Panthers, and granted this was an emergency hire, handing the keys to Andrew Brunette were done because they felt, you know, they were undefeated, and the systems that Joel Quenneville created along with the Brunette were all working. So there's no reason to, you know, that's why the Tortorella stuff never flew with me. Like, why the hell would they want to change course after an undefeated start with systems that have been proven to be working for two seasons? So there are some times when you want that continuation, but hiring a coach is very much just hiring a personality, I think, in a lot of ways. It's the personality of the style of play in which you choose to play on the ice, and then it's the personality behind the scenes. And that's why I think the Berube example is an interesting one, because what essentially did he do? He brought accountability to the job. Mm-hmm. He bought a guy who's a big, burly, tough guy, and he created a situation. If you remember this, one of the biggest reasons the Blues won was because they had this unique ability, and this tracks right to Berube, according to the players, to forget about failure. Okay. And to rebound from it quickly and to move past mistakes. And if you think about the kind of calamitous things that happened to that team in the playoffs, as far as like the glove, the puck off the glove and all that other nonsense, like they moved past it. And, yeah. And you know, that was a huge thing. So hiring a coach is very much about the way you want to play, but it's more about the motivation of players. And in some cases, just severing the relationships that certain players have with the current regime, and then just giving them a fresh slate.
How much do you think Daryl Sutter has should be credited for how the Calgary Flames are playing?
He should get all of it. Like, I mean, you know, like you look at Markstrom's numbers, right? And you know, the one thing that we've remember from the LA Kings runs is Jonathan Quick winning Jennings trophies and stuff like that. I mean, you know, the system that Daryl Sutter plays was going to be beneficial to one of the single most important players on the roster, which was the guy they handed a giant free agent contract to 2 years ago, like a year and a half ago. So I think he deserves a ton of credit. The unforeseen thing when it came to the Flames was the offensive output, which is something that I think is beyond what any of us thought. It's funny. I was talking to somebody the other day about like the Battle of Alberta and, you know, how it's going to be fun to watch the high-flying Edmonton Oilers against the, you know, the Daryl Sutter Calgary Flames. I'm like, these games could easily be like 7-6. You know, like both these teams can score pretty well. And so that's the part of the Sutter equation that I think was a bit of a surprise for some of us.
Do you think the Oilers are going to get a goalie before the playoff starts?
Absolutely. 100% they'll get a goalie before the playoff start.
Who will that goalie be?
I mean, you think about the league and the landscape and who's available and who might be hitting free agency and stuff. And I think one of the first places I would probably look is Columbus, and someone like Corposalo, for example,
right.
would probably be a name that would come to mind. But beyond that, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with who's not in the race at that point in the season. But yeah, I think they're going to get a goalie, because I think that they're going to make an enormous push at the deadline to make this the year. I think they know they have a little bit of something. I know that they don't want goaltending to be the death knell of what they have. And I think that Ken Holland's going to be really aggressive at the deadline, not only to improve in goal, but to improve in other places.
Jaro Halak is a decent candidate in Vancouver right now. His cap hit's just $1.5 million. He's got pretty good.
When are you guys trading Brock? When are you trading Brock Besser? And do you think he'd look good on Jack Hughes' wing?
Oh man! Oh, there you go. That's a new one. We just circled back on the Besser to Minnesota stuff, because that's easy. That's the one to do. But yeah, no, I don't know. Everything's on the table right now. I don't know if you heard Canucks general manager Jim Benning last week, but everything is on the table. Locally, the one that kind of raised everyone's eyebrows yesterday was a report from the province that the Minnesota Wild had called not on Brock Besser but JT Miller. Besser's name's always going to be out there because he's got a contract due at the end of the season. It's honestly all, but that's the thing. So right now, Wish, in our hit with you, we've talked about a potential president of hockey ops. We've talked about a potential coaching change, and we've mentioned two different trade scenarios. That's the current state of affairs in Vancouver right now.
It's a bit of a bummer. Yeah, I think Miller probably has value. The thing about Miller and what might differentiate him from Besser is just his versatility to play in any form of the lineup that you want him to play in. I mean,
he's the type of player that can really thrive in the playoffs. Like, he does play a pretty heavy, strong game. He's not the fastest guy on the ice, but he has a tendency to make these bizarre bad passes, like these bad forced passes that end up in giveaways. But there's no questioning his effort when he's out there. He is he's an emotional guy, and I think sometimes the emotions might actually get the better of him. But and here's another question: like, why do you think he's been traded so often?
Because he has value. I mean, you know, like if somebody's dangling a one, and you need to create salary cap space, if you're Tampa, you're definitely going to deal him.
Yeah, he's like that level below a franchise player that can be traded.
Yeah. Totally, yeah. And I mean, like you said, the North-South game, GMs love. He's got playoff experience. Like, he's a very – I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he has more suitors than someone like Besser, despite Besser's skill set. And by trade Besser to the Devils, I mean, he's a throw-in in the Quinn trade, right, to the Devils. Is that right? I mean, that's the part that I left out.
Why do you have to do this?
You have to unite the Hughes Triforce at some point, boys. It's going to be the best thing for the league.
Remember when they got all four Stahls together for that one game?
Trump became president. Isn't that what happened? Yeah, it broke the timeline?
That was the chronology of it all. Yes, that is exactly what happened. Yeah.
It was like crossing streams in Ghostbusters.
Yeah, people always say it's the Cubs winning the World Series. It was when all the Stahls played in the same game. That's what broke the timeline.
We're speaking to Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. And we're up against it for time. Greg, thank you as always for the hit. We really appreciate it. Be well, be safe, enjoy all the action this week. We will talk again next week.
Thanks, boys.
Thank you. Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show. I'm sorry I cut you off in your line of questioning so I could talk about bars. I was just really intrigued by them.
Yeah, that's okay.
Sorry.
We just had something going there with the
Jim
Rutherford conversation that I think people were interested in. And then you were like, so all the bars in the Islanders' new arena.
Did you go?
The one that that's cool.
The one that really amazes me is the speakeasy.
Because I think it's a great idea, actually.
So, again, if you want to...
change the location every game.
Oh, yeah, that's a way better idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now you don't know where it is or how to get in. But when you get...
Could do that too. I was like, we had no sales in the speakeasy. No one could find it.
Guys, we may have gone too far with the hidden aspect. But it's funny because I saw pictures of it, and he's not joking. You can't watch or listen to the hockey game when you're in there.
It's just a bunker. Oh, the Canucks need something like that, for sure.
Imagine paying, well, for bad teams,
the escape room.
Yeah, jokes write themselves, right? For $200, you can go to a hockey game and not watch it.
And there's booze,
right? But it's really interesting that's a cool wrinkle for a good team. For a bad team, it would be like the escape room.
I think they had to make sure that this arena was fun.
It looks cool, man, honestly.
But it surprised me that they don't allow tailgating, because that was such a big thing at NASA.
Yeah.
With that massive parking lot that they had, and we would all see the pictures of Isles fans tailgating like it was a football game. Apparently, they don't have that there. We've got an open segment coming up at 8 o'clock. Sean Gentile will join us to talk about the Pittsburgh Penguins, the Canucks' opponents tonight. We can also talk more about Jim Rutherford and why he left Pittsburgh, and maybe if he wants to become the president of hockey ops of some team, maybe, I don't know, a team that could use a president according to our poll question.
One that's maybe in Canada.
But you know what we haven't done much of this season?
Good radio?
Yeah. Baseless trade speculation.
Nice. I do like that.
There's talk out there that the Canucks are looking to make a trade. In the next segment, we'll run through the most likely candidates to be involved in a trade. It's the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.
7:33 on a Wednesday. What a wild Wednesday it's been. Half Lord Brough, Sportsnet 650.
Half Lord?
Now you have to explain to everybody why you're saying
half
that.
Lord.
Dom tweeted out a clip of us discussing Doug Jarvis.
Well,
if you want to hear two people in real time learn that someone has a job with the Vancouver Canucks, download the clip. We played that.
And there's been way more Doug Jarvis talk this morning than I expected there to be.
This is your home of Doug Jarvis, Sportsnet 650. We put the clip up on the Twitter machine. It's kind of funny. It's one of those little slice of life bits from Halford and Brough. Off the cuff, where you're yelling at me and I'm Googling. Classic Halford and Brough. Except Dom spelled Halford, H-A-F-L-O-R-D, a.k.a. Half-Lord.
Dom is definitely a Can Cucks guy.
Yeah.
Oh, the amount of times.
No kidding.
You don't
say.
Yeah. He spelled Vancouver School of the Arts with a six.
Yeah. All right, we teased this segment in the last segment. We're going to do some baseless and rampant trade speculation with the Vancouver Canucks. We all know yesterday JT Miller didn't attend practice. Now it turned out that
they
it was just a maintenance day for JT Miller, apparently, according to what the club said.
Yeah. It's if you believe big hockey.
But as soon as Brendan Batchelor tweeted out that JT Miller was not on the ice for practice yesterday in Pittsburgh, everyone was like, yep, he's traded. Because there had been talk. There had been talk that the Minnesota Wild called on the Vancouver Canucks about JT Miller and that other teams were calling the Canucks about their players. I think there are three players that are realistic to trade at some point. Maybe not now, but between now and next offseason.
Did you make a list?
No, it's honestly off the top of my head.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't think they're ready to trade Pettersson or Hughes. Like, those guys, to me, are still in the untouchable
area. Yeah, there's no chance.
Area because you're not going to get full value for, especially Pettersson, the way he's playing right now. This is not the time to trade Elias
Just
Pettersson.
Take him off the board. Don't worry about it. They're not moving. They're the untouchables. Whether you like it or not, that's what's happening.
But JT Miller, Brock Besser, and Bo Horvat, let's just say that I don't know if those guys will be Canucks in 2 years. So you have to look at, can the Canucks extract some value from them now, if or between now and, I don't know, the offseason? Because JT Miller and Bo Horvat are both pending unrestricted free agents in less than 2 years. So they've got the rest of this season and then the season after that. And then they can just walk away for nothing, like Chris Tanev did. And Jacob Markstrom did.
Tyler Toffoli.
And Dan Hamhuis did. And they can just walk away.
Yep.
See you later. No asset gone. Another asset dying on the vine. Now, you can resign them this offseason as well. But then, especially with the JT Miller contract, you would have a significant age risk then in that JT Miller is approaching 30. Brock Besser, the Canucks have to make a decision on this guy, whether or not they want to keep him long term. Because he's a pending restricted free agent, but there aren't many RFA years left for Brock Besser. Yep. I think there's only one. And so he could essentially accept a qualifying offer for the Canucks and play out the year, and then he could leave as an unrestricted free agent. Yep. So the Canucks have to make a decision soon on Brock Besser and whether or not he is a guy that is worth signing to a long-term contract.
Yeah, and
if they think he is, great. You're going to have to sign him to a long-term contract. If not, you trade him to a team that does want to sign him to a long-term contract, and that's how the trade would go. Trade him to a team that has a contract essentially in place for Brock Besser.
But the problem, of course, is that Brock Besser has probably not been more ineffective than he's been through the first 20 games of this season, and his qualifying offer, that cap hit, is $7.5 million. So it actually really muddies the waters about his value and what you would get in return. Because I'm just, call me naive, Jason, but I would think that a player that's underperforming quite significantly, that is due a significant pay bump, might not be the most attractive thing. Also,
some teams take chances on them, though. Like,
but think about
the Montreal Canadiens with Josh Anderson. He was coming off he was about the same age as Besser, and he was coming off a bad season, which he didn't score. He had injury concerns, and the Habs still wanted him.
Yeah, but they didn't have to give up that much for him. They gave up Max Domi for him. Like, that's what I'm saying. If you're the Canucks, you're probably not going to extract that much value. Or not as much as you would if you were a good team where he was winning. And then, of course,
well, the alternative is signing him to a long-term contract extension, and I think there would be quite a few people out there that would think that was a risk, the way he's playing right now.
All long-term contracts are risks, but I see what you're saying. It just that's one of the guys.
So you have to make the decisions at some point. Like, all right, is this a guy that we want to go long term with? And if not, you have to get as much value as you can out of that player. The last option and the most unacceptable option is just letting that contract expire or, you know, going to UFA.
That's also an option that's happened quite often in this market, unfortunately. So who are some of the guys that you've identified or guys that you could conceivably be traded? Because remember, everything is on the table. General manager said it. Everything is being looked at. Agents are in the mix now, too. Trades could happen.
It's funny. I mean, there is a list that I came up with, but every player, there is a big but, right? Like, but. So, for example, Tyler Motte could get something at the deadline for sure. There'd be a lot of teams that would want a Tyler Motte type energy player, bottom six guy who's a very good penalty killer, who's on, most importantly, a cheap contract.
Yep.
He's got a cap hit below $1 million. There's value in that. But the Canucks need penalty killers. They don't need fewer penalty killers. He might be their only good one right now.
Right. Here's the thing. If you're doing trades where you're kind of waving a white flag on the season, all due respect to that unit, it doesn't matter if you trade a penalty killer away or not. Like, if you're not trying.
Well, it does if you want to re-sign him.
Right. Well, that's a different conversation.
But then you get into the position of, then is he still a value player because he's going to want to raise?
Yeah, exactly.
So you've got so Tyler Motte is a guy they're going to have to make a decision on. What about Jason Dickinson? There might be value in him on his contract. He hasn't done much for the Canucks, but I think he's still probably got value around the league. But the but there is, they only just got him.
Yeah, I feel like I still have no idea what Jason Dickinson's game, when effective, I suppose, looks like. Because right now everyone's saying, oh, he's quietly effective. I'm like, well, the quiet part is certainly there.
I think he plays a heavy game that is solid defensively.
But his 5-on-5.
When he's playing well.
His 5-on-5 metrics, like, he's not dominant. Like, he saws you off.
Nobody's dominant.
No, I know, but that's what I'm saying. But everyone's saying, like, he's doing the job at 5-on-5. I'm like, he's sawing the opposition off at 5-on-5.
Well, he's a massive failure on the PK right now.
I thought there would be a little bit more tilting of the ice, if only maybe in just, like, straight possession time. Like, you said he plays a heavy game, and I do agree with that. I thought that would translate into more elongated zone times, you know what I mean? Like, maybe some work below the goal line.
I
would could point to and be like, that's his calling card.
I don't think I have a good read on Jason Dickinson yet.
I don't.
Not yet.
I'm just waiting for something where I'm like, oh, that is where he can thrive. And again, I thought it would be a lot more puck possession stuff, but it's not there.
Another guy that might get some attention because he's a veteran guy that's played in big games before is Tanner Pearson. Here's the butt part. I don't know if that contract is, you know, palatable to any team. Tanner Pearson isn't playing very well right now. He's getting a little bit older. And he signed a, what was his contract? 3-year extension? 3.25. Okay. So as soon as Tanner Pearson signed that contract, a lot of people said, well, there's the next Beagle. Or there's the next Antoine Roussel. And all of a sudden, you've turned a player into, at best, a neutral value asset or a zero value asset.
Tanner Pearson also has a full no trade clause.
Full?
Yep. In 22-23, it becomes a modified no trade.
So Jaro Halak is another guy that maybe could be traded at the deadline, but
if you're a veteran backup goalie, I feel like you might not want to sign in Vancouver, because the last two, I don't want to write off the Halak thing right now, but it certainly looks like he's probably not thrilled with the way things are going.
He's probably not thrilled with the fact that he's not playing much.
He's on a bad team,
yeah,
and he doesn't play much on it. And when he's played, they've given him no support in terms of goals. And then Braden Holtby, I don't think we need to revisit that entire saga. That was obviously a bit of a disaster.
Miller worked out.
But Miller was a starter, right? Yeah, well, they weren't asked. I mean, these guys are being asked to caddy. I do kind of wonder what the sales pitch is to get them into town and then what the reality is once they get here. And, I mean, if it's like twice burned, you've got to think that there's guys around the league being like, I don't know if I necessarily want to go there.
I think for even an older goaltender, working with Ian Clark has some clout as well. Yep. Guys would come just specifically for that.
Yeah, I just don't know if the idea and the ideal is actually matching up to the reality.
So a couple other names that I would throw out there, Travis Hamonic, right shot defenseman. We all know that there's not enough right shot defensemen in the league. See the Vancouver Canucks as an example. Now, he's got this year and next year under contract at $3 million. Once he gets fully vaccinated, that issue kind of goes away. again, his contract might be, he might be kind of in the Tanner Pearson camp in that there would be interest in him, but would the Canucks be willing to retain salary? And I don't know if the Canucks are just, they can't keep doing this. They can't keep trading guys and retaining salary because it chips away at your cap space. Doesn't seem like a lot if you retain like $1 million here or there, but it all adds up. Luke Shen, maybe.
We're
Alex Chiasson, maybe.
We're here,
that's
eh?
It, though.
November 24th.
They're not going to trade Pod Colson. They're not going to trade Nils Höglander. I don't think they're going to trade Pettersson or Hughes.
No, they're not going to. You know what the biggest impediment to all this is, though?
Maybe Rathbone. Maybe they trade Rathbone. But I don't know how much value Rathbone would have right now.
But you know what the biggest impediment to all this is? And we brought it up about a million times on the show. They are in such a position of weakness when it comes to negotiations that they're almost going to get hamstrung or fleeced on any deal. Any deal. And then you start asking, well, are you selling to a team for futures and you try and replenish the draft picks? Well, that's great in theory, but who often are you selling to at the deadline? Competitive hockey teams, teams that are willing to make a run. Where do competitive hockey teams usually finish in the standings? Near the top. What does that mean for those picks that are coming back? They're not going to be top five or top 10. It's all kind of shrouded in a cloud of negativity. I'm sorry if this is a bummer.
The team is a bummer right
now. I'm sorry if the exercise of going through the list and then getting down to Luke Shen and Alex Chiasson as trade candidates on November 24th is depressing, but it's on the table. I cannot stress this enough. When you say that you're looking at everything, it means you're looking at everything. It means you're taking calls on anything because you have to try and fix what's going on.
Here's a question for you, and I'll throw this out to the listeners as well. If there is a new general manager, if there's new management, do you want that management to aggressively trade guys? Do you want one of those? Jim Rutherford is not afraid to pull the trigger on big deals. Pulled the Phil Kessel trade.
Yeah,
he got good players to that team. He added a bunch of defensemen.
His calling card was he made a lot of trades.
Yeah, some of them didn't work out.
He's also famously maybe the only guy that Jim Benning's ever fleeced on a trade.
Yeah, he's also a guy that believed in Jack Johnson.
Yeah.
Right?
And Erik Gudbranson.
But here's the thing. He made a lot of deals.
Oh, sure.
Jim Benning has actually made a lot of deals.
Yeah, I don't think
we've had some big trades to discuss in Vancouver. But do you want a general manager that's going to come in and swing for the fences or make a bunch of deals? Or do you want a guy that is going to commit to... Do you want a guy that is going to commit to the core, which is not necessarily JT Miller, because I think he's a little older than the core, but do you want him to be like, no, I believe in Pettersson and Hughes and Horvat and Besser and Thatcher Demko and just try and do a better job of building around that core than Jim Benning? Or do you want him to come in and be like, we're going to make some deals. You may not like some of the fact that we're going to ship some of these players out, but something dramatic, something drastic has to change for this team to turn things around.
No, because I think if you do that, you're just acknowledging and really sending a message, a smoke signal out to the rest of the NHL that you're open for business at this particular moment.
What's the alternative, Mike?
The alternative is don't sell a bunch of your assets for 50 cents on the dollar because you're the new guy in town. They're already losing anyway.
What is the alternative?
The alternative is
stick with the group.
The alternative is
stick with the group.
The alternative is
you've done grand, laddie. Now you know what you have to do. Burn the house down. Burn them all.
I mean, you've got to acknowledge if some guy comes in and just starts trading everybody away for 50 cents on the dollar, then what you're talking about is recouping something for these assets is totally lost. You're talking about
dramatically changing the mix of the team.
You could dramatically change the mix of the team today if you wanted. If you want to send everybody out, but it's a ridiculous notion because you need to get stuff back.
I think your notion that the Canucks wouldn't be able to extract value for the likes of a Brock Besser or Bo Horvat or JT Miller is incredibly flawed.
Why? Because they're in such a position of strength in negotiations
because
right now?
Our team
stinks. I have a general manager that hasn't really won a lot of these trades in the past.
Because those are good players, and good players aren't always available at the trade deadline. JT Miller at the trade deadline would get a return. Bo Horvat at the trade deadline would get a big-time return.
Yeah.
So that's my argument.
But what kind of return are we talking about here? What's the bar that you're going to have to hit? Because I would say
that's another good question. What do you want to get back? Do you want to get first round draft picks back? and then build again.
And that's where I came back to my original argument that if you're getting first round picks from teams that are contending at the deadline, those aren't going
to
be high.
But
first
I want
round
a
picks.
General manager to come and fix this, because what's the, like staying patient with this is not the answer. Something has to change.
Mm-hmm.
Something major has to change because this team, I agree with that. As currently constructed, yeah. is not good enough. And if you are going to make major changes, they're going to be dramatic.
Well, I agree with that. And that's what everyone on the planet that covers this team, either directly or indirectly, has been saying. Everyone's waiting around for something to happen. Right? You're in that boat as well. You just know that the way things are going can't continue. So something's going to have to change at a multitude of levels, which is why we spent a considerable amount of time talking about the executive, a lot of time talking about the coaching, and now this entire segment talking about potential trades, because that's what's all on the table.
Like, for example, I think they should be shopping JT Miller. I think they should try and be trading JT Miller. I don't think he's a guy that this team should be re-signing, because I think the re-signing risk for JT Miller is huge. He's not particularly fast right now. He's getting to that age of 30. He's going to demand a lot of money on a contract. Mm-hmm. So let's start it now. Get the talks going. It might be that you trade JT Miller at the trade deadline, but get him to a team that you can say, hey, you're going to get 2 years of JT Miller.
He's cost controlled.
Cost controlled with a good contract, and then you can make the decision whether or not you want to resign him.
I'll say this: at $5.25 million, Miller is borderline outstanding value. At the very least, it's really good value. That is a great contract for a guy that, let's remember, when the bubble happened, that's the only time I'll air quote bubbles to this show, I promise, was garnering like Hart Trophy votes and was a point-a-game player, and he can do those sorts of things. I mean, look at his production, just in terms of counting stats, is really good this year. He's putting up points. He's scoring goals. He's doing it on a team where he's getting absolutely no help from Besser and Pettersson and Horvat. I mean, he's doing a lot of this on his own. So in that regard, you would say, yeah, you could extract a ton of value for him. The counter argument to that, which is what I keep coming back to, is, yeah, but can you get it in this climate?
Yeah, you can if you create a bidding war.
How many? Okay, well, you got to think about three things. One, how many?
You need two teams to drive up a price.
One, how many teams are going to be able to bring on that hit? Because we are still dealing with a lot of teams that are right or near the ceiling, and that's a thing. Two, how many teams are actually going to want to bring them on? And I would say, well, you can drop half the league out, the teams that aren't in the playoffs. If you're not in a playoff chase, you're not going to go get them. He means nothing to you.
God, I miss the old NHL. I really do. The salary cap has just ruined the notion of the mid-season blockbuster trade.
Well, that's what you were talking about earlier. Like, is someone going to come in and is someone going to shake it up? And I'm like, it would be cool if it was 1992 all over again and you could do that. Right?
The Canucks made a trade, I think it was 90 or 91.
I got to go back and look at it. I thought it was 92.
They acquired Cliff Ronning, Jeff Courtnell, Robert Dirk, and Sergio Mimesso. And I think there might have been a pick in there for Garth Butcher.
1991.
For Garth Butcher and Dan Quinn.
Courtnell, Dirk, Mimesso, Ronning, and a fifth-round pick for Butcher and Quinn.
Look, just these massive.
The old six-player trade.
During the season.
Yeah.
Because there was no salary cap. You're just like, GMs could act more recklessly and with more courage in their deals.
Well, there also used to be
right now.
There also used to be a notion that you could save your team and save your season. And you could because you could fundamentally alter your team and your season.
Wayne Gretzky was traded.
No, I know, but
mid-season it didn't work out for the St. Louis Blues. But like, what a massive
the one you're talking about was like a volume trade where you actually brought in four or five new bodies,
and it paid dividends. Cliff Ronning and Jeff Courtnell were terrific Canucks.
So on that note,
you can basically change. So ahead of the '94 Stanley Cup playoffs, they bring in Jeff Brown and Brett Hedekin. Mm-hmm. That's two top four defensemen they just brought in.
Yep. And that,
can you imagine what two top four defensemen could do to the Vancouver Canucks right now?
Well,
turn their season around.
On this note, in a very weird way, I got this in the notes here. I don't know if you saw it.
It's just frustrating. There's no. I'm not offering a solution. I'm frustrated that so many teams, including the Canucks, during the season, they just kind of throw their hands up in the air and they're like, nobody has cap space. We're paralyzed.
Yeah.
There's nothing we can do.
And that's the negatives of the hard cap. But that seemed
what the Braves did during the World Series.
I was just going to get to that. In a weird way, teams giving up on the seasons, because some people say, well, that doesn't exist anymore. What you're suggesting doesn't exist in sports anymore. It absolutely does. Because if you look at baseball right now, the same dynamic applies. Teams fall out of the race and give up and start selling. But some teams, because they're not financially hamstrung, are able to go out and completely reinvent themselves midway through the year, which is exactly what the Braves did. The Braves completely, you talk about the top four defense back in 94, the Braves did that to their outfield. They bought a whole new outfield at the deadline, including Soler, who ended up being World Series MVP. And they went from being a 500 team in a weak division to completely revamping their team. And honestly, baseball was crapping on it. Scott Boras went up and said it was a bad thing. And I remember thinking and seeing the quote at the time and being like, I don't know if that's a bad thing.
He was talking big picture in that teams don't have the incentives to be competitive.
But he was also dumping on the Braves, saying that they were a 500 baseball team.
He wasn't dumping on them.
He was. He said that there were teams that strategically planned.
He was dumping on the team. No, he was dumping on the teams that sold the Braves, those players.
Read that quote again. He says that the Braves basically didn't do any planning and didn't strategically set themselves up like all these other franchises that won 100-plus games. And they just kind of were a middling team in a bad division and then didn't basically won their World Series in 6 months. They didn't have anything to do with long-term strategic planning.
So Gary Maple Ridge texted in when I said, I think the Canucks should be looking to trade JT Miller. He said, you're going to trade your best player. I don't want you to be my GM. What's your solution then, Gary? Do you want to sign JT Miller to a long-term contract extension? Because that's going to be what he's demanding.
Or do you want to let him walk?
And JT Miller is 28 years old right now. So that's going to be, you know how old Lou Eriksson was when he signed that contract? Around 30. And he was a 30-goal scorer the season before. You have to be very, 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 very careful when you sign players at that age to big contracts. For example, lots of the players that the Canucks have signed. That's why I'm talking about trading JT Miller. I don't see the Canucks winning a Stanley Cup in the next 2 years. So the best option is to extract the value you can right now. Asset management, finding value, things the Canucks have not done a good job of over the last few years.
Did I say $5 on the dollar? That's my financial understanding. I think I meant to say 50 cents on the dollar.
The official financial sponsor of Halford & Brough is ZLC Financial. It is not Mike Halford. It's your one-stop solution for all your financial and retirement needs in Vancouver. To learn more, visit ZLC.net. And remember, advice is only as good as the person you ask.